I've fished around a lot of black bears, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah. Mm-hmm. Never really worried about them. I don't know if I was just desensitized or what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then in Idaho, came across a very fresh grizz track.
Yeah.
Now, grizzly's a whole other.
That
the grizz is the biz.
Yeah. That yeah, one, yeah. I'd made it like 100 yards from my truck, and I was like, that's... Oh, and then I start staring at it, and I see the claws are like 2 inches from the pads, and I'm like, that's a grizzly, and I didn't have my bear spray.
Welcome to the Bunkhouse Podcast, broadcasting from the confluence of outdoor recreation and nature connectivity. I'm your host, Josh Crumpton, founder of Spoke Hollow Outdoors and the Los Savaje Food Truck. My life as a rancher, guide, foodie, and conservationist has provided the opportunity to meet some really great people. And the Bunkhouse is where we get to introduce them to you. Welcome to episode 13. It's been a minute. September 1st has come and gone, hunting season is in full swing, and things are busy around the ranch. We dusted off our scatter guns, took the dogs to the field, shot a ton of dove, hunted teal for 6 days, and introduced 26 new people to hunting. Our current focus is on packing up and getting ready to head out to far west Texas for the opening of blue quail season. But I still found time to catch up with my homies, Chris Trout Whisperer Cantrell and Davin Whiskey T. Topol. It's been a while since the three of us have had the opportunity to sit down and share a bevy, and it's cool we get to share the experience with you. We talk dove openers, cocktails, Paloma Blanco, Campo Paloma, shotgun fitting, bear country, fishing, wild game cooking, teaching, learning, wanton waste of game, what makes a good guide, and general adventure shenaniganry. I enjoyed making this one. I hope you enjoy it too. And as always, let's get this thing started.
It's been a while since we've all been in here.
I mean, you've been traveling quite a bit. I've been traveling quite a bit.
Yeah.
A lot of moving.
I was gone all summer.
You were gone all summer. <Let's> go. This is the first time we've all been in the same place at the same time.
For more than like 30 seconds.
Yeah. I think since last spring.
Yeah.
Man, I don't want to get deep into our summer. That's a whole nother thing. But September 1 rolled around.
Mm-hmm.
Davin, you and I have not shot birds yet.
Not
together.
Yet. No, this is a very odd feeling.
We've all shot birds.
Tried to.
Shot at birds.
We've all had a shot at birds.
We've all seen some birds. We've been doing some heavy bird watching.
A lot of catch and release.
Yeah.
But it's like dove season. So this is, you know, Davin, you and I have been doing dove season in Texas for a long time together. This is the first year.
This is the first year, yeah.
In what, four years?
Yep.
That we haven't been together on the opening day?
Yep. I had some conflicts with work, and I ended up in Colorado the opening weekend during Christmas, Texas Christmas.
Trout fishing,
though. I got some trout fishing in. It was a killer concert. Red Shahan puts on the Caveman Festival near Trinidad, Colorado. And we did find some creeks out in the area. One of them was in the Bosque de Oso Canyon, which I later found out meant Bear Canyon. I found out the hard way. Like, I wonder, that's a beautiful name. Let's go fish down in the canyon of the Bosque de Oso. Okay, that's beautiful. And get down to the river and like, what is that? That's a bigger dog track than I thought. Oh God, that's a
big dog.
Bear trap. That's got to be like, then that's bear shit. Oh, and there's a bear up in the tree.
Did you keep fishing?
Yeah, we did.
Good job.
Yeah. Honestly, we got out the first day and we didn't even realize what was going on. Like, we just, you know, let's go find some fish and got out the first day, fish for a good 4 hours or something like that, and then headed back to the car. And that's when we saw our first bear. On that first day and realized, oh wow, we were playing with fire.
No, you were playing with bears.
We were playing with bears. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next day we went back and I was decided, let's go ahead and carry the gun. Mm-hmm. And that's when we really started looking down at the ground and seeing tracks like everywhere and bear scat everywhere. Like, how did we not notice this the first day? It was like kind of set in like, oh gosh, we were really in a dangerous place because we were in tall reeds and the willows that grow up near the banks of the river.
Yeah.
And yeah,
you wouldn't see them.
No, we would have been just face front. Yeah.
You had a big old bear track.
Yeah,
Cantrell, you had like a decent bear track encounter while you're fishing.
I've fished around a lot of black bears, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah. Mm. Never really worried about them. I don't know if I was just desensitized or what.
Mm. Yeah. But
then in Idaho, came across a very fresh grizz track.
Yeah.
That, grizzly's a whole other
that
the grizz game. Is the biz.
Yeah. That yeah, one, yeah. I'd made it like 100 yards from my truck, and I was like, that's... Oh, and then I start staring at it, and I see the claws are like 2 inches from the pads, and I'm like, that's a grizzly? And I didn't have my bear spray, and I immediately went and retrieved my bear spray, and I was puckered up. I kept fishing.
You had your bear agitator with you, too, though.
I did. Like,
that's any dog.
I had my bait.
Yeah. I'm just going to tell you, dogs in bear country, they don't really mix that well.
Yeah.
Because the dog will like immediately go, look at this big thing I need to bark at. And then it'll bark at it. And then the bear's like, man, you are a jerk. And he like just takes the dog out. And then he looks over at you and is like, did you bring this asshole to the party?
Oh, I'd have been gone.
Like,
yeah.
I apologized to Bodie the minute I saw it. I was like, sorry, bro.
If you guys, I don't want to get too deep into it, but like Yellowstone, the greater Yellowstone area has had, I think it's been like 4 bears shot this year.
Yeah, I
saw with big game hunters. Recently, you guys
there's
see that?
A lot of there's a lot of action with attacks, and they needed to de-escalate the attacks.
Yeah, in all the attacks so far, none have been found that the hunter was at fault.
Mm-hmm.
But these were aggressive bears or in the area, which is. That's it. You know, the thing is,
so they weren't throwing up the middle finger at bears from a distance.
No, these were all of these have been pretty like close range encounters with bears. The ballistics have shown that they've been close range. And so, you know, the hunters have not been found at fault. But if you're out there, my dudes in the western states, please take care while you're out in the woods. Ed Anderson talking to you. Brother Ben over in Bozeman, while you're out there, you know, be careful. But I don't want to get too deep into that because that's a whole nother topic. And we're in Texas. And fortunately, we don't have to worry about grizzlies in Texas.
No grizzlies here. Black bear.
No.
Black bear.
But on the wing shooting front, we've all been in different places. You were at Paloma Blanco.
Yep.
How'd that go this year?
That went fantastic. That was a super blast, as usual.
Always a good time.
Just the pechanga of the year.
Yeah.
When it comes to dove, good times, good people. It was a lot of fun.
Well, we kicked off 2 dove events this year, Campo Paloma here in Central Texas and the one in South Texas, which you'll be at next year.
Yeah.
Both of them. Going to wrangle you into both. Because you were gone for the first, and then you were just getting back and doing family stuff. But Chris, you were at both.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess the first one, not really.
The first one, I was present. And then my truck fell apart, which is a whole different thing. But we hunted the San Marcos Fields opening day, and it was awesome. Yeah. And then I was here for the very end of Campo Paloma, kind of the wrap-up evening, both nights. And it was awesome. I mean, it was great.
We had 270 hunters over the first 3 days of opening season. And we estimate that we shot somewhere around 2,400 to 2,500
I heard there was birds. A lot of birds here. There was a lot more than I had expected for first year, you know. You got it set up earlier this year. You were getting stuff set up. But it exceeded the expectations of what I thought was going to happen.
Yeah, it was a banner year.
I saw a lot of birds leave the property on social media. It was good. It looked awesome.
Our dude, Mason Lively, came out and played.
Yeah.
That was fun. Evan Leroy was cooking. And did you get some of the barbecue?
I did. It was delicious. It was fantastic.
Yeah. He's masterful. Did you get to, because I know you were down at PB on work. Did you get to shoot a little bit?
I got to shoot a little bit. I did a lot of cocktailing and stuff like that, getting set up with all hands. And I put together, you know, the Paloma Blanca is John Dunaway's words, a circus. So if you're not bringing the heat, you know, you may as well not show up. So, of course, I brought the heat. I put together kind of a cocktail where I took the top off the all hands, added ice. And then I threw on a cup that had fruit, gummy bears, chamoy, chili, lime, salt, and then topped it off with the rest of the cocktail. and added a straw so that you could drink out of the top of it. And so I did a lot of...
It was a fiesta. That's a party.
It was a pachanga and a half.
Party.
Yeah. But no, so I did get a little bit of shooting in between. Not a lot. It was hot. It was hot, as you know. Like it was...
Yeah.
I made the mistake of walking a field once and then realized I have to walk back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Okay. But made it back to some shade and took a break. I got a few birds out of the weekend. It was, I mean, you can't beat it.
How was your shooting? We were down there the days, like 5 or 6 days ahead of PB, and we were hunting and at the campo. And how was your shooting? Because you were kind of off down another area. How'd it go for you down in Brownsville?
I had a blast. I shot horribly. Dove are my nemesis, but
they're tough.
There was a lot of opportunity. It was great. I had a ball.
Yeah.
I had one day of that as well.
I had multiple day of, like it was the 12 gauge did not do me well. I switched to the 28 and had a great time. And then I went back to the 12 and shot poorly. And
so you were hitting them with the 20 instead of the
28.
The 28. Yeah. That Franky.
Franky 28 was doing great with it. And then I went back to we ran out of shells and then went back to the 12 where I had more. And it did not.
You just like shooting him in the eye. That's all.
Well, what was the choke difference? Did you know what chokes you were running?
I was running. I looked back on it. I had a modified choke in my 12, and then the 28 had an improved up top and a modified blow.
Were you hitting him on the first shot? Did they improve the more open choke?
It was kind of 50-50. I think after talking to some people that know a lot more about shotguns than I do, like my length of pull matched a lot better on that Franky.
Oh, is the length of pull off?
Yeah.
It was longer on the
12. I got short arms for my height. So
yeah, I mean that's the thing. It really having a gun that fits makes a big difference.
It was tough shouldering the 12 gauge compared to the 28. Like just getting it up and in place and then tracking with it was a lot smoother with this with the 28 with that Franky specifically than I was using my good old 870 and then Caleb's wonderful Stoger. And they were his gun was like a full inch longer than my 870. And then that 28 was a little bit smaller. And I shouldered that 28 just a lot faster.
Yeah.
I could keep, my eye down the barrel a lot easier and I shot better with it. And then I'm just terrible at shooting dove. So.
Well, shooting dove is hard.
It's not. No, just
in general,
it's not like, easy. I feel
they
like
they don't track like a duck or a quail. You don't know. You can't anticipate their motion.
No. And they
a lot
make
of it's pass shooting.
Yeah, yeah. They make quick movements. You know, like no other bird does.
It's like Barry Sanders trying to.
Right. Yeah. They're juking and they're juking all over the place.
They're smaller. But the thing is when you hit them, they go down.
They die.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the biggest challenges, getting the lead on them. But it's the length of pull is an interesting thing because it is, I think, probably one of the most important things in the shotgun is getting the right length of pull. And I have a lot of people who ask like, oh, I'm going to get a custom shotgun and they're going to spend a lot of money on a shotgun. And there's two things that happen, right? So you can get a gun that is the proper length of pull and fitted to you. And that can be really important. Or sometimes people get a gun that doesn't have the proper length of pull and is not fitted to them, and they adjust to the gun. So you have a lot of shooters who will adjust to the gun, or you can have the gun adjust to you. But the biggest thing in being successful in shotgunning is practice, 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 because the most important thing is having a consistent mount. And I get people who ask me, should I get a custom shotgun? My answer is always, do not get a custom shotgun until your mount is consistent. Because until you're mounting the gun the same way every time, you get a custom gun, it won't matter.
It's not going to match your mount.
No, it's not going to, because your mount's changing all the time. So it's good that you've dialed in on the length of pull. So more importantly than getting a custom fitted stock is to get in the right length of pull and then continue to mount that gun. And clay shooters, my buddies who competitively shoot, they like leave their gun in a place they can get to it easily, which I don't recommend. You should probably lock your guns up at all times, but they continually come out and mount their gun several times a day at their house. Like they're not shooting clays. They just throw that mount up over and over and over. So they get that muscle memory going.
It's gotta be super intimidating. Your neighbor
Yeah, for sure. Like I, you know,
his gun out again. Is yeah. it for us?
Is it us? I mean, I've been peeping in his window at night all the time.
Quick, get down! He's getting his gun.
He knows we're watching him. He knows.
No, he doesn't. He gets his gun every time we're watching him. You're watching him all the time.
Who's really at fault in this situation? Who's the creep?
But Dove, have you cooked any or any Dove that you've
shot?
No,
I have not yet. Yeah.
How about you?
Oh man. I figured out. I've had them a few different ways now. I'm gonna, like the poppers, I know that's the classic, but it's like it's a lot of work to not taste a dove.
Yeah.
It's
a texture thing.
Let me do everything I can to just like I'm gonna eat these dove, which I fully respect.
Hide the flavor of that sweet meat.
I fully respect that like you are eating
what you call it
shot.
Sweet meat.
Sweet meat.
Okay. I just wanted to rewind and play that back. All
right. But to me it's like it's a lot of work to not taste a dove. And I like the taste of wild game. Yeah. So I've had it just like, you know, pan seared and eaten like that, cut up and put on some eggs or something. But I recently just deep fried them like chicken nuggets.
You did that for your folks, right?
I did that for my folks who are not the most adventurous eaters all the time.
Did they enjoy it?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Loved it. And just a simple, you know, panko and flour and egg and, you know, 45, 60
seconds.
Did
you tell them what it was?
I did. They were well aware. They were watching me clean them up. and it was great. It wasn't like the breading wasn't overpowering. It wasn't too much. It wasn't, and you could taste the dove. And I like the taste of dove. And it was,
yeah.
And they're
that's
easy to eat.
It's one of the best meat.
It is. You can get like I said, it's almost sweet.
Like, it is. And you like if people aren't as into, you can give them a dipping sauce, break them into it. It's an easy way to do it. Poppers are like messy and like they're delicious. No, there's nothing against them, but it's like a lot of work to not
cover
taste.
Up the dove.
It's like liver. People do everything they can to eat liver and not taste.
God,
it.
I love.
I liver. Like liver, but
I
like
still haven't done liver. It's one. Really? Yeah.
It's like what you do liver, like a medium rare liver with
just organ meat in general. I haven't really done a lot.
I've had some foul liver in my day, but I've had really good stuff that was just simple.
Like definitely like duck liver,
not duck
foul
like
liver,
elk liver, and it was like. Bleh.
I like foul liver.
I've had
sandal crane liver.
FOWL liver is good. I've had duck liver. I've had goose liver. I haven't eaten crane liver.
Throwing the dad jokes. Crane liver is good. What I think is it's like the whole fried dove approach. Super simple, easy way to showcase the bird. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like, you would put yours down for what, like 45 seconds?
45 seconds to 60 seconds.
Yeah.
If it goes past that, it's tough.
And that immediately becomes really, like, really liver tasting. Like, strong and like, and not in a good way, liver taste, but bad.
It's similar. It was very similar to duck in that matter. Like, if you overcook it, it changes not just the texture, but the flavor of the meat in a not pleasant way, but like that sweet spot, which is right around 45 to 60 seconds in 350 to 360 degree.
Yeah.
Peanut oil. And they were like fork tender, delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the chicken nugget brought to you by the wild. It's what I love about dove is it's just really, so like duck, wild duck is obviously different than store-bought duck. But like dove, the only way you're eating dove is you got to go out there and work for it.
You got to get it.
You got to go get that. And that's what makes it so, to me, it's so special. It kicks off hunting season. It
doesn't have that gamey, like what people think of gamey flavor, right? Exactly. If you cook it properly, like it's mild as all get out.
Well, if you take care of it properly, because let's be honest, like a lot of things like that people are like, oh, I had venison one time and it was real gamey. And I'm like, well, that's because your grandfather like threw the dead deer on top of the hood of his car and like did a parade around the town with it a few times before he drove an hour and a half to the processor.
Yeah, exactly.
After he gut shot it and didn't properly clean it in the field. And it doesn't taste good. Let me go take that prime rib and like, you know, let me take your ribeye, your prime grade ribeye and drag it around the ranch in the dirt a few times and then cook it for you and see if you think it tastes good.
It's boiling.
Maybe leave it out. This ribeye tastes gamey.
Yeah.
It tastes real gamey. That's because I drug it through the cow pasture.
No, I did that on purpose. It's like dry aging, but not. Yeah. I just drove it around aging.
Yeah. I mean, there is definitely, and there is some sentiment, there is a little bit of truth to that, but like, you know, as Michael Pollan points out, like people get attached to the taste of corn.
Yeah.
These are not corn-fed animals, so they're not going to have that corn flavor to them. But the reality is game handled properly and prepared properly should have an amazing taste to it.
You can add corn to it.
You can. I suppose, if you're in the cooking process, I suppose.
Cornmeal, add corn to it.
Add cornmeal on add the outside of it.
On the outside. Use a corn tortilla.
So you've done some cool stuff with Dove. Did you do like a ramen with Dove last year?
Yeah, I did
a
ramen last year. Cooked them medium rare and then just sliced them and used those as the that protein with the ramen. Did boil down the bones too for the... For the broth.
Oh, the stock's
the best. The stock. Yep. Mm. And then added just a couple of basic, kind of more on, it was more along the lines of like a pho or a pho.
Pho.
Wherever you're coming from.
Pho.
Pho. Is it pho?
It's pho.
It's pho.
It's pho. I wanted to open a truck. Like, this is fair game to anybody listening to this. I wanted to open a pho and barbecue truck and call it fuck you. But
fuck you with a Q.
Fuck you with a Q. Yeah, yeah. Like pho barbecue. Anybody can have that. It's free. Thanks.
It's you're I welcome. Like it might you're be welcome. Brisket on
it
some.
Might, I searched around. I didn't.
You
see
put
it
brisket
anywhere.
On pho. Like, mm-hmm. Oh my god.
Well, that's a classic.
It's so yeah, exactly. It's I mean, it is. It's already there. So like, how is somebody not doing? Fuck you.
Yeah, for seriously. Yeah. You
but
like
yeah,
fuck you?
So I did that. All it really to make the broth is star anise is like the big kicker for like pho broth, coriander, fennel. Just boil all that down with the bones and a little bit of salt, a bit of miso.
Yeah, it looked delicious.
It was pretty good. I definitely would do it again. I'd probably do that for these ones too because I don't have a lot of birds. So.
Oh, yeah, you gotta stretch them.
Yeah,
gotta make them stretch.
Count. That's right.
Or come get some more.
I could come get some more.
You know, for me, if you're not making stock with your dove carcass, then I think you're totally missing. Which I love spatchcocking them and cooking them skin on, but I also really like breasting them out, taking the breast off, and being able to have that extra meat to make that stock. And I just do it with celery, onion, carrot, just a standard stock. And it is like one of the most delicate, fine. I'll put a little like miso in it and just have it just that way. Or sometimes I'll just add a little salt and just drink the broth. Like, yeah. I mean, that's
the one delicious. Thing I will do this year, though, I didn't do last year. And I don't know if you do it, but I want to roast the bones a little bit before I boil them. I want to get the meat off and then roast it. And then
I leave the meat on for flavor and I brown them in the pot.
You brown them in the pot. Okay.
That's the key. So you don't really have to roast them. It's too delicate. I think they're
I take
delicate.
The meat off. And what the plan is to take the meat off, sear the meat to medium rare, and then roast. Just throw them in the oven. Throw the bones in the oven for.
So if you take them a little oil in the pot and then just like brown them in the pot, that'll straight like put some in like not all. You leave a little meat on. There's like whatever the. And you brown them off in the pot. Okay. It'll be a similar sort of.
Because that's
like,
the thing too, right? Because you can over roast it. Like how long are you gonna put it in there for? The bones are like this big.
They're very delicate bones. Yeah. So they can burn pretty fast. So I really like
that's
to
a
just
good idea.
Sear them in the bottom of the pot and then just like then I'll take those out of the pot. And I'll leave that oil and then I'll put my carrot and celery and onion in, saute that off. And when that's translucent, then I put those bones
similar
back in.
Similar you would do with like shrimp or shellfish.
Like, like a shrimp bisque.
Got it.
Like you wouldn't roast those because it's more delicate like a shrimp.
You're just not going to put it in the oven. Yeah. Okay.
So that's my, and plus you get the benefit of like having all the drippings off of that browning like straight into the space.
No, that's a good idea. Yeah. Okay. That's what I'm going to do this year then.
Well, I'm going to come over for dinner.
It's happening.
How many dove did you shoot?
Three.
Okay, so I have more than that. I'll bring some dove over for dinner.
I need a few more.
So yesterday, so we missed you at Teal Camp.
Oh,
it was terrible. Actually, you didn't miss shit. It was the worst. Awful. No, we opened. We kicked off wing shooting season with September 1st. We did Camp of Paloma. We had a bunch of great hunts. And then I guess it was Teal opener was like 14th or something like that.
Somewhere around there.
And we went down to Garwood in that area and we shot with Tobin and Andy and those boys down there. And we had a really good Teal opener.
Yeah.
It was kick butt. It tapered off pretty fast at the end. Mm-hmm. Like the tail end of Teal season this year, because I just don't think these birds are migrating down. It's been a hot year.
No reason for them to move down.
No,
south
it's like they're hung early. Up.
Yeah.
Like I've been hearing about people in Lubbock having great shoots.
Well, Lubbock
still
is
shooting
basically
dove.
The Midwest.
Well, they're shooting dove, but like right now, those dove shouldn't be up there anymore.
Yeah.
They should be down here. And I'm hoping this last storm that we just had
It was a killer storm. Yeah, a lot of water.
I think it pushed in. I think it's probably pushed birds. This cold front is going to knock down the birds. I bet you there's going to be teal everywhere. But we did have a great few opening days. We shot with Amber from McKinnaquin, her group.
It looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was those ladies were amazing, talented shooters. And we knocked out a bunch of teal, which was a lot of fun. And we made one of the things we made at camp this year is we made a deconstructed gumbo, which turned out. Did you have some of that?
I looked at it. I saw the picture.
Oh,
it looked good.
Man, it was like, so I took teal breast and we made a roux. Mm-hmm. We made a gumbo base, vegetable gumbo base, right? And then I took the teal breast. We breaded the teal breast, buttermilk soaked them, bread them with panko. And I fried the teal breast, which I don't fry teal breast a lot of time, but man, it was amazing. And then sliced that. And we put rice down, put the teal breast on top of the rice, and then on a plate, put the gumbo roux around
the
it.
Rice.
Okay. Yeah. And then just like, and then we had a little bit of like, I think there was a little sausage involved.
I was going to say,
there was like a little sausage involved in the roux, but not too much though. Parsley on top of that, and then serve that with both fried okra and then a sauteed blistered tomato okra with onions, like a salad. Man, it was freaking good.
Okay.
I ate it like three times because we had three camps. So I made it three times. And I like each
and you
time.
You cooked at each camp.
Yeah.
You
oh, yeah.
It.
Did you do
breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Yeah, we did it all. It was,
and then Matthew, I'm sure, was involved with the. With
he
the
didn't help at
always.
All, to tell you the
no,
truth.
I
like,
know.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
He just sat back taking photos the whole time. I was sweating. No. Matthew worked his ass off.
Yeah,
He did a really.
It's a lot
job.
Of work, though. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. That's one thing about your hunts and things that when you do like your hands-on, you know, your recipes, your cooking, you're doing the thing, and you and I both love doing that. It's like if we're not doing that, we are constantly looking in the kitchen. Can we help?
I know. Can I help?
We go and do things at other lodges. Like I want to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. Cantrell got a taste of that this year.
Yeah.
He came and helped a little bit at Campo Paloma and got a taste of being in the kitchen some. But then also I was like, you need to go. Just go sit down and eat. And he's like, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
It's hard.
Like you struggled with that a little
bit.
No,
I don't. I'm not comfortable.
No. As a guy, it's a guide thing.
It's like, a guide thing.
I can't sit and let other people do
I'm used
the
to.
Things.
I did a lot of like overnight river trips, floating. Yeah. And stuff. Like, I know my place and it is not with the clients. Like I am the help and I'm okay with that. Like,
yeah. You were the client though.
No.
Part. You were in you were a tweener.
I was a tweener and I know like I'm always gonna like lean towards the non-client side of things.
Yeah, but you know the biggest thing about that is like you're in there, you're jamming your deal, and it's sometimes it's like, man, I want the help, but like I can't stop to tell you how to help me.
Yeah.
Like I just gotta keep this train rolling and you go tell stories. Go tell funny stories. And then that's when I realized I made a mistake. Because Cantrell was like, so one time I was in Vegas. And I was like,
the only person talking is Cantrell. It's not
never a good thing.
Laughing.
Never a good
like,
thing.
Wait a minute. What's going on out there?
People start leaving. Emails get sent out.
It's 5:00. I'm going to bed.
He's like, these stories work great on the boat.
Let me tell you about Tijuana.
Oh, man. But
well, it's hard when your friends are like doing the work. You want to hang out with your friends too.
Yeah.
It's like a comfort zone.
Yeah, it is. You're like, I want to be throwing in with my friends. The other day, I have two birds that I need to clean. They're on ice in the fridge right now. But like the other day, I went out, Chris came out, and I invited Johnny, my 10-year-old, out, and I was like, hey man, you want to go shoot some dove? And he was like, no, not really. And I was like, okay, are you sure? He's like, okay, well, I guess so. And I'd asked Josie, my 3-year-old, hey, you want to go dove hunting? She's like, no. And like then Johnny was like, I want to go. And then Josie was like, I want to come too, Dad, from like the other side of the and I was like, oh, okay. There's not going to be any dove shot today. And like, so I loaded everybody up in the Ranger. We went out, we took Rowdy. And so my 3-year-old, this is Josie's, the 3-year-old, hung out and Jeannie came out and Johnny came out. And there was so many birds at the beginning. There's a lot of birds.
There were a lot of birds.
There was a lot of birds. But we were trying to get all of our poop in a group.
Yeah.
And so the 3-year-olds kind of run around. The birds are like, what kind of coyote is that? As they flew away. So we managed to shoot a couple birds. At the point that we were able to shoot these birds, what was really cool about that is that my daughter was like able to see the process of actually killing an animal. And now we're going to be able to step through the process of harvesting that meat, and then we're going to cook it. And that I'm just sharing because I'm so stoked about that.
Yeah. No, it's super exciting.
It was interesting when she did say, I'm waiting for it to wake up.
She did say that. That was part of the process. It's part of the process. I'm waiting for it to wake up.
A very important part of the process.
Yes. It is. And so we're going to have we had a conversation that was like, it's not going to wake up. It's dead. And now
the flavors will awaken. It will awaken with flavor. It
will awaken with flavor. But now it's going to be a process of like, you know, show it, that animal now becoming food. And removing the feathers and actually cooking the
And you're going to have her, there.
Oh, yeah. She's going to help me clean the bird, and she's going to help me cook the bird.
Making sure.
And then she's going to help me. I mean, I'll have her up at the stove while we're cooking the bird. And it's just going to be this experience that I wish I had had as a kid. This whole, like, here's an understanding, this understanding of life and death, the understanding of the price that has to be paid for us to eat meat. You know, and just this organic acknowledgement of the circle of life.
Hakuna Matata, something like that.
Did you guys have that at that age? Because I didn't have that at that age.
No, I'm like, my family's from the West. We're from Colorado and New Mexico. And my dad grew up, you know, hunting deer and elk. And my mom grew up kind of fishing. But I moved to Kansas when I was like 9 or 10 years old.
That's a hunting mecca, by the way.
Yeah. We didn't understand. We're Western hunters. We didn't understand. My dad didn't understand really the how you go about hunting all the private land, or like what has to. Kansas is like 2% public land.
So he didn't hunt. Did he quit hunting?
He went pheasant hunting like one time, and he brought home the pheasant, but it had already been breasted and dressed. You know, it had already been taken care of. So we never we had it fishing. We used to go fishing a lot, but it wasn't like. Thumping a trout is a completely different process than like shooting a bird on the wing or a large game animal. It's a lot more removed from the whole circle of life process, in my opinion. It's a lot easier. You view this like fish as a fish. It's like
soulless,
pretty much. It's not viewed the same as like it's a flying or walking animal. Yeah. It's viewed very differently. And so I didn't have that at all growing up. Like I was aware of it, but I didn't have that connection. I didn't start hunting until I was an adult, really. And didn't have that, you know, moment until I was older with friends instead of, you know, my folks. But I think it's awesome that you're having it with your kids at this age.
Oh, I wish I had that opportunity when I was growing up. We did not hunt. My grandfather hunted, but that was way before, you know, I was even born. I think he was done hunting by the time I was born. But we did a lot of fishing. Coming from Minnesota, we did a lot of fishing. And we ate a lot of fish. So saw how harvesting something and then killing it, filleting it, cooking it, and that whole process. But like Contrell said, like
it's not the same.
It's not at all.
It's not the same.
Because then when you do finally come to that that time of like, I've taken an animal's life, whether it be a bird or a furry creature, squirrel. I think that was probably my first. I think it was like a bird. Dad had like a blow dart gun, and that was our I would hunt as a I guess I did hunt birds as a kid.
What kind of birds?
Game birds.
Yeah.
What's a statute of limitations on that?
What is a statute of limitations?
I mean, fair enough. Gamey birds, sporty birds.
I think I was probably like 7 or something like that. And then killing a squirrel for the first time, it is different.
Did you kill the squirrel with a blow dart?
I killed a chipmunk with a blow dart. The squirrel was with a slingshot.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Did you eat it?
No. This is the terrible thing.
That's the thing.
I didn't grow up like I grew up. I was just a boy with a shot or with like a slingshot and a
out on your own
gun.
Rolling around.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Not knowing what's
causing
going.
Chaos.
Right.
But the interesting thing is like you were living your predator. You were going to your roots. You're going to being a predator.
Yeah. But didn't fully understand what to do with it. And then I think I ate my first squirrel when I was probably 12 or something. A buddy of mine shot a squirrel and like, we're going to skin it and eat it. And I was real excited. And yeah, so we did that. But yeah, didn't really start hunting until I moved to Utah and started with ducks, started duck hunting real heavy out there. And then didn't take my first big game animal until I moved to Texas.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show before.
Yeah.
Cantrell's bit with a duck bug lately.
Oh, I love ducks. I always have. It's been
rebitten with the duck
re-bitten.
Bug.
I get reinfected every now and again
with duck hunting.
Oh yeah, he's like, I see him looking
bad.
At like things for the boat decoys. Yeah. He's like, we could hunt the Colorado with this kind of spread.
You just get some fast grass. Just
I've been such a gypsy for so long. It's like hard to like duck hunting's an I used to jump shoot a lot. Like
yeah.
Blast, like cast and blast, going up rivers with a fly rod and a shotgun and like shoot things when I could. And if I couldn't, I'd go fishing and it was fun. But like then.
That's opportunistic duck hunting.
It is.
That's different than like duck hunting.
And then I went on a couple years ago, I went on a guided duck hunt with my brother in Oklahoma and that like ruined me. It was like saltwater fly fishing for the first time when you come from like a freshwater background. You're like, now.
Talking to the ducks? Are you kidding me? You can talk to the ducks and tell them to come to you?
Is like really. Experienced awesome guides like and like having the whole lay we're in layout blinds like coffin blinds and there's decoys on the ponds or we shot a peanut field one afternoon and like watching these guys that just knew what they were doing and they're like there's 7 gadwall coming in. I'm like, I can tell you there's more than 4 birds in the sky and you're telling me those are gadwall, and they come in, we shoot them, they're gadwall, and I'm like, this is the coolest shit in the world. Like, I want to do this and get good at this. And then, like, now I have a boat that can function as this. I have, like, time and, like, a little more resources to be able to get into it. And, yeah, it's gotten bad. Mm. I love duck hunting. Calling them in, like, oh.
Yeah.
And then they're delicious.
They are delicious.
They're delicious.
So, in my duck hunting journey, I got to, I sat on a pond this season in early teal season with Rowdy with my black lab and a call and no guides, and I shot ducks, and it's
a feeling,
man. It's like that whole duck hunting without a guide. I mean, like, I shoot upland and I'm a proficient, upland hunter, maybe more than proficient, some would say, but like ducks have always been this thing that I have tried to not, because I just don't have the bandwidth or the time, so I've tried to like, I'm not gonna do it. Well,
you're doing
we're gonna do it. Nah, we're gonna do it this year. It. Yeah, it's all in.
It's inevitable. Yeah.
Ray Penny, G&H decoys, you hear that? We're gonna do it. So we need to figure out some decoys down here in Texas. So
well, it's the whole process. It's like the getting up early, the setting up,
it's the
like,
ritual of everything.
It's
right?
a very yeah. ritualistic yeah. process. You know, dove hunting, it's like we're gonna go sit out in the field, throw up a couple mojos, still a hoot. And you sit there and you're like, I'm going to leave. But like duck hunting is like this intensive process. Like when I was jump shooting a lot and just still killing birds and having fun. But like when I did that hunt with my brother a few years ago in Oklahoma, like I'm with a bunch of people that I don't have a lot in common with. And they're good dudes. I just don't. And I'm like talking to this young guy and I'm like, can I go help? And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, can I go? I want to learn this, man. Mm-hmm. Like we went out and we were hunting a peanut field and we set up like 200 decoys.
Yeah.
Layout blinds. I'm like. Going over the process, and I'm next to him just harassing the piss out of this guy while the ducks are flying. Like, what are you using that call for? What's this all about? I want to learn. And he's like, he was totally cool with it. He's like, nobody asks me this ever. They all just like,
they just
get my birds and go.
Just be a shooter.
They just want to shoot. And like, I hear all these stories about like, you're out of the blind at 9 in the morning. And like, but these guys are out there the day before. They're out there at 3 o'clock.
They're
in
out
the morning.
There the weeks before.
And weeks before. They're working 20 hour days
that's
for you to shoot for 3 hours.
About. Yeah. Is how people approach their hunting, you know, experience. Some people have grown up hunting and that's how they know hunting is just like, I just show up to a field. Everything is done. We get our birds and we go like, and that person can also say, I started hunting really early. Like, but did you get the experience that, you know, a lot of us are like coming into hunting in a later time in life and like appreciating what we're getting, you know? So you have several different kind of aspects of people coming into hunting with different, you know, outlooks.
Well, I think in Texas specifically, it's one of the challenges that you get in Texas is because of so much private land, because so much of it is guided, so much of the experiences you have here are guided in the state, that people show up as just shooters. I'm mm-hmm. just here to pull a trigger. As you move out west, for those Westies that think they're better than everybody, but whatever, that's another conversation for a whole nother show. Westies. But like for those guys, it's like when you hunt public land, typically you're doing it all yourself. So you get a deeper level of engagement. And I think that there is a good place here in Texas where you can have both, where we in the industry can make the concerted effort to make that connection to nature. And that's ultimately what you're talking about. The difference here is getting a deep understanding of the nature that surrounds the species that we're hunting. Like, why do you use this call? How do the ducks respond to that? Why do you set up this spread? Why did we set up near this field? Why is the wind in this direction? And all those answers are like, well, the ducks are going to come in this way because the wind is this way. And we use this call because they think this. And we're on this smart weed because of this. And if you show up to just be a shooter, you're going to miss all that. And to be honest, for me, that's hunting. It's not pulling the trigger.
They're shooting and hunting.
Yeah, there's shooting and there's hunting. And I think that we here in Texas, the fishing industry and the hunting industry can push ourselves to be better. And in the fishing industry, the equivalent of what we're talking about with duck hunting is like indicator rig fishing off of a boat with a nymph rig with no understanding, but other than the guide telling you set. I might be turning the tables on you here a little bit.
At one point in time,
a guided fishing trip meant I got in a boat and somebody taught me how to fish. Like, not just try to produce results.
I try and do that. And I'm sure Davin does with your trips too. Like, you're an educational guy. Yeah. And it's like, I ask people at the beginning of the day, like, what do you want to get out of this mm-hmm. trip? Mm-hmm. And they're like, I just want to catch fish. I'm like, all right, I'm going to instruct you as best I can, because if I can make you a better angler, you're going to have more fun out here. Mm-hmm. Some people, and it's a very small percentage, don't want to listen to you and they do their thing, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. The majority of people want to learn. And so I try and, you know, I'm not going to go through knots. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. That's like,
I'll tell you where to go. I'll give you the resources.
Yeah, I'm like,
go
YouTube is phenomenal for knots. Sure,
on the boat is not the place to do that.
Not the place, but I'm going
to
tell
you. One of our fly fishing 101s, that's the place to do it.
Here on the ranch, you can learn everything you need to know in those 101s to make you proficient to go out on your own or like improve your skills on a guided trip from there on. But like, I try and make it as an educational experience as possible, because I think that's how you're going to have the most fun. And I think fishing, it's a little easier to do that than maybe hunting, because hunting, it's like on and off. Uh-huh. It's like, and you never know when it's going to happen. Like, uh-huh. you can pull a boat over and be like, well, you know, sit around here for a minute. But like, birds can come at any minute, a deer, an elk, or whatever can come at any second.
It's about that time that you start packing up or start messing with knots.
But a lot of it's the downtime in between, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so a lot of it is like just not even the knots, because like, here's the thing, is that still like skill level stuff. So what I think is cool is like, tell me about the plants I just rolled by. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the birds I just saw. Oh, well, that's a kingfisher, and like da, 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 that's an osprey, and blah blah blah.
You have to be, because like, those downtimes on a boat get real quiet and awkward sometimes. You do.
And that's a turn point, is being able to educate people on the nature that they're in. And I think that, I feel like Instagram has worked against us a lot. And like, I mean, I know some guide companies in the space that like every photo on their feed is of somebody holding a fish.
It's a misrepresentation of the activity, and it produces like the worst false expectations of what the whole trip is about.
Absolutely. Because it's not why you go out there. And what happens is it sets up guides to be in this space where it's like, I got to produce a fish in this person's hand because they need a fish for their Instagram, because I saw so-and-so who's a big popular person and all of their feed is holding fish. And like, so I'm going to throw a call out, you know, on the five people who listen to this show. I'm throwing a call out that like, you challenge everybody else that you know in the fishing and hunting space to show more of the story. Tell more of the story. Like, I mean, just tell more of the story, because it's not the fish. It's not the bird. You went out there. Look at that dog getting pet by Davin.
I'm telling you. Like,
what is this dog's name?
He's a Muppet.
Sawyer, right?
Yeah, Sawyer. Sawyer the Muppet. Hunt him up, Sawyer.
Go get him.
Where's
Sawyer?
The birds?
It's like, all I hunt is love. Hugs and kisses. I'll hunt
the
those
challenge
up
is like, challenge somebody to to show more. And our friends in the industry, challenge them to show more. Enough like, show me something grins. Cool. Yeah, enough grip and grins.
Yeah.
Over it. It's dumb and it's promoting the wrong thing.
It's the worst. It's going to be a whole entire podcast about it, but I think it's been a huge... Instagram is great for a number of things. I think it's been a huge detriment to the outdoor industry because people's expectations are only seeing the most beautiful places in the world, only shooting the biggest animals in the world or the most of, you know, birds or the biggest fish. And it's like a lot of times on my trips, I'll stop in a pretty spot and I'm like, don't forget to look around. Like, look where you're at right now. Look what we're doing. Like, it's not just about this. It's a big part of it, but it's not the entire, especially when you're paying for a trip. Yeah, you're paying to catch fish or shoot birds. It's not going to always happen, but like, appreciate like the fact that you're just out doing this.
Well, let's just be honest. Let's just go back to the internet's roots. It started with pornography. So unrealistic expectations have been at the baseline of the internet since the beginning.
I'm not going to disagree.
Hey, look at this. Oh, I can't stop looking at it.
Oh, man. Okay, so I got a thing I want to read. This is out of TPWD Game Warden Blotter. An employee with a mobile home park contacted Harrison County Game Wardens to report 18 duck carcasses in the park dumpster. Following a lead from the property manager, wardens identified and located the suspect. The suspect confessed that he attended a guided duck hunt and accepted ducks from two other hunters without a wildlife resource document. Following the hunt, the suspect threw the ducks in the bed of his truck and traveled elsewhere for another hunt the next day. Back at home, the suspect said he no longer felt like cleaning the ducks and threw them in the park dumpster. Multiple citations and warnings were issued for failing to keep ducks in edible condition, possession of ducks without a wildlife resource document, violation of daily bag limit, and over the limit possession. Civil restitution is pending. This is the game warden blotter on this. So like, I want to like, there's a few layers here of like, you know, that I want to dive into. But first of all, like, what do you guys think about that situation?
I've not seen it, but I've known hunters that I was on a hunt with, and we shot ducks, and they didn't want them. And they're like, take them. Mm. And like, one hunt, I took them. I was very early in my hunting days, and I didn't know that I was well in excess of, you know, we all shot our limit. And I was in excess. I was traveling home with an excess of my limit. I didn't shoot over, but my friends gave me their ducks and we ate them all. It was, you know, they didn't go to wanton waste or anything, but I was on a different hunt and the guys were like, I don't want anything to do with these. And the guides, to their credit, were like, you have to take these.
Yeah.
Like, it is against the law for you to not take these. And I'm guaranteed those guys chucked them in dumpsters, unfortunately, but like,
that's such a bummer.
They didn't want anything to do with them. And I don't know. I guess there's a document where somebody give you their birds?
There is. And so that's the first.
But what if it puts you over a bag limit, even if they're from somebody else's hunt?
You're okay as long as you're not over legal possession limit. So that the first step is like, A, there is a document. I'm going to post it on our Instagram, on the Bunkhouse Instagram. There'll be a link to it. So you can fill out an affidavit, a document to transfer your birds to a person that can carry them. Now, they cannot go over their possession limit, but they can hold those birds.
So I know it's a different place. So what do you know what the bag, like what's the bag limit versus possession limit versus species in Texas? Just we'll go specific.
So possession limit, teal, is 6. Regular ducks is 6, but it's 5 mallards. Only 2 can be hens, 3 wood ducks, 2 redheads, 2 canvasbacks, 1 pintail, 1 dusky. All other species outside of that, gadwalls, widgeon, all that is 6.
That's 1 day's limit.
That's 1 day's limit. Yes. And you can have 3 times a bag, 3 bags. So you can have 18 ducks total with you, but no more than aggregate to those specific ducks. So you can't have more than 15 mallards with you. And you can have only 6 hens with you. So, I mean, that's where ducks get crazy because you get into those different like species bag limits. But that possession limit, I believe, includes ducks that have been given to you in transit.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not gonna rule in and like, don't call your attorney. I'm not an attorney. And what I will say is that I definitely have seen duck processing places, or like taxidermy. So like possibly if you're processing, you can have a higher number than that, because I definitely know that taxidermy houses have more birds. And I definitely know that duck processing places have more birds. And I definitely know that like game processors for deer have more. So I think we should get a game warden on the show and like really go through that, because that's where this stuff isn't super clear. You can dig through, and I've dug through the code, and it still doesn't leave you in a place that is super clear, you know?
So it's, yeah. Is it just blind eye? No actual special licensing for these special organizations, or is it just blind eye?
I don't know. I'm not going to give the definitive.
Right.
I default back to a possession limit personally, but
as a civilian that is not a taxidermist or is not a game processor, I think that's where you're going to get in trouble.
That's going to be the place.
That's, yeah. I mean, just play it safe and do not accept ducks. Do not give your ducks away if you like that person.
Without an affidavit. First, you got to use the affidavit, which you can get on the, we'll put it on the IG for Bunkhouse. You can go over there and grab that. One of the things that I thought was interesting in this is the waste of game, like, which is what you were hinting at, is the guy was like, dude, you got to take your ducks and you need to eat your ducks. Those are your ducks. They belong to you. And there's a lot of ethics involved with that. Like, I can't see giving away game that I shot. I'm like, I came out here. I spent money to be here. These ducks are, I mean, by the time you're finished, if you're on a guided hunt, it's some expensive meat. And honestly, by the time you're finished on a DIY, it's some expensive meat.
Yeah.
You take the amount of time of scouting into account and ammo and camo and gas, and that meat is going to be pretty expensive, particularly with birds.
Yeah.
With an elk, you might get on a better per pound basis, you know, maybe, but like with birds, they're expensive.
It was an interesting situation. Like, the guides were like, one guy was stoked because we had, you know, it was a group hunt. There's a lot of, we had different species of birds. You know, we were having to look and see, you know, making sure nobody was outside of certain limits. And I, you know, I took one guide and decided, I was like, I want the 6 best eaten ducks in there. Uh-huh. And he was,
what'd they give you?
The 6 best eaten ducks in there.
What were they?
Was it? Gadwall and Wigeon, Lesser Canada. I think that's what I went home with. But some of the guys wanted taxidermy birds, which, you know, no problem there.
I dig
there.
That. I love a taxidermy.
But, you know, there were some people that didn't want anything to do with them. But I was like, because we shot so many different species that day. It was incredible. It was awesome. But, like, I was like, I want the 6 best eaten birds. And the guys were like, nobody ever asks these questions. They just, like, take them home and deal with them. Like, no, I love eating game. Like, I want this to matter. And they, like, you know, this dude picked out. And nobody else in the party cared. Like, they were fine with me taking home the best.
Right,
six,
right.
But, yeah.
I wasn't like, screw you guys, I'm getting the best ones. But, like, I was, you know, it was a weird experience being, like, one of the only people there. Like, really, there was a couple, like, two or three of the 8 of us were, like, really, really interested in eating the ducks.
I would have had some affidavits and been like, I'll take yours. I'll take yours. Wow.
Well, I'd say also be careful on those possession limits. You can't have a possession limit on an opening day.
You know? No, yeah, you can. If you have an affidavit,
an affidavit.
Yeah,
if you collect somebody else's birds.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're by yourself,
yeah.
You can't have a 3-day limit on opening day.
No, you've busted your bag at that.
That's what he's saying.
But what I thought was interesting about this was the citation for the violation for failing to keep ducks in edible.
That's a fantastic condition.
Yeah.
That's a great, I mean, because there's a lot, we could break that down in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, edible condition is, man, you let those ducks sit out for 7 hours, they're not edible anymore. But I threw back to the code. I want to read the code from Texas on waste of game and get into that a little bit, because, like, so as you start to peel the onion on this stuff, and I'm gonna fall back to none of us are attorneys, and you can't hold us accountable for anything we say here. This is strictly our opinion as we read these things. You know, we are outfitters. We do take people out to these things, but we're going to get into a little bit more esoteric questioning of the code. Like, there's definitely ways to live that you know that you're on the right side of the code, but I've got some questions that arose off of this waste of game that I just want to talk through with you guys. It's an offense, Class C misdemeanor. If a person while hunting kills or wounds a game a game bird or game animal and intentionally or knowingly fails to make reasonable effort to retrieve the animal or bird and include it. This is the key. And include it in the person's daily or seasonal bag limit. It is an offense if a person intentionally takes or possesses a game bird or game animal or fish and intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, or with criminal negligence, fails to keep the edible portions of the bird, animal, or fish in an edible condition. Is a Class A misdemeanor to fail to retrieve or keep an edible condition on a whitetail or mule deer, pronghorn antelope, or desert bighorn sheep hunted without landowner consent from a vehicle, boat, or aircraft on a public road at night or with the aid of a light. What? Oh yeah, let's unpack this whole thing.
Whoa!
I want to start with the back end of this, right?
Yeah, let's go from the back forward. Okay,
so the back forward is
a shooting light is for a reason.
It's a Class A misdemeanor. I'm going to read that again. It's a Class A misdemeanor to fail to retrieve or keep an edible condition of a whitetail or mule deer, pronghorn antelope, or desert bighorn sheep hunted without landowner consent from a vehicle, boat, or aircraft on a public road at night or with the aid of a light. So you're out poaching.
Yeah.
You're going to get slapped with a misdemeanor if you don't go in and try to get the animal. So you're doubling down here like you're poaching. So you're already effed. It's crazy that there's code that deals with a poacher and says if you're poaching, it's worse if you don't try to go get the game.
Yeah.
You're getting a misdemeanor on top of like whatever the
I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if you're going to shoot it, you better go get it.
Better go get it.
So you can avoid your Class A misdemeanor on poaching charges if you go get it. Some of these laws are, it's pretty wild, right? Like, but it's clear.
That took me like you reading it three times to understand it.
Yeah. It took me three times reading it to understand what I was reading too. That it was basically like if you're a poacher and you shoot something and then like, you know, you just like, you're like, oh, I don't want to go get it. Then we're going to slap you with a Class A misdemeanor. I think it should be bigger than a Class A.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Is like, well, if you don't go get it, like a misdemeanor, if you do it, and if you don't go get it, like we're talking federal offense.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's as it should be. Now, granted, all of those animals listed, you'll notice in the Texas code is this Class A misdemeanor. It is a Class A misdemeanor to fail to retrieve or keep in an edible condition a whitetail or mule deer, pronghorn antelope, or desert bighorn hunted without landowner consent from a vehicle. But yeah, that's all correct. So we read that correctly. If you are poaching, you're going to get hit with a Class A misdemeanor. Right. But what's interesting to note about this poaching and misdemeanor charge is none of that is on migratory species. So this isn't a federal law. This is a state law. These are state managed game resources that the state of Texas has decided we're going to throw a misdemeanor on top of things if you're poaching, if you don't try to get it. Shouldn't be poaching to begin with.
No. I think most states have a wanton waste law.
Mm. Which is that's what this waste of game. So backing up into this a little bit more, getting into the waste of game a little bit more, this is what I really want to talk about. If a person while hunting kills or wounds a game bird or game animal and intentionally or knowingly fails to make a reasonable effort to retrieve the animal or bird, and there's two parts to this, and include it in the person's daily or seasonal bag limit. How do you guys read that?
So that means if I say I'm dove hunting and my limit's 15, I think this might have gone further into that. So I shoot, I kill 15 birds, I only recover 10. I made a good effort to recover those five, though. Mm. I didn't find them. I still
can't. That's a bad. You need a dog.
Yeah. I can't shoot 20. I can't kill 20 because I lost five and bring home 15.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this? So how do you read that?
Yeah, it's basically you have to at least go out, make that reasonable effort to go out and find the birds. If you cannot find the birds, then
they still count against your bag.
They still count against your bag limit.
Yeah. So that's the way I perceive and hunt. But I'm going to read this again. So, and like, there's a lot of gray here. Like, what is a reasonable effort? Like, we're using terms like reasonable effort. That is very subjective. Like, what is a reasonable effort? Is it reasonable for me to walk 600 yards across a pond to retrieve a bird on the other side of the pond if I'm 20 years old or if I'm 80 years old? Reasonable effort is now the sliding scale based upon physics. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm just going to point out what I think are some, like, A, you should always try to retrieve all the game that you shoot. B, I always count it towards my bag. That's my personal. But reading this code, reasonable is a weird. That's like, can, what's reasonable? Like, what's it, you reasonable?
Can you can spin it however you want. If you're, you know, if you feel that, like, you made a reasonable effort by putting the gun down, putting the safety on, putting a gun down and standing up and looking and saying, can't get it.
Is that reasonable? I don't know if that's reasonable or not.
In your mind, like,
well, that's what's weird about this law. It's exactly. the weird thing about the law.
According to who?
Yeah.
You know, and so
the game warden looking at you through the binoculars.
Well, right. that's what it comes down to is a lot of it is situational. A lot of it's at the discretion of the game warden.
And it's going to be, if it goes to court, it's going to be at the discretion of the said judge. Like,
well, yeah, and the game warden's probably going to weigh in.
Yeah. The game warden's story, your story. As a judge, I'm ruling that you didn't, right? Like, that I'm in ruling of whatever the game warden said. You just stood up and looked and just sat back down and started shooting again.
Yeah.
That's not okay. We're going to slap you, you know.
And yeah.
It may come down to that to find out what reasonable is.
Well, here's the weird thing about this. But this is why. So at the end of this, like, I've kind of got my cautionary telling what I would default on all this, is that reasonable effort to retrieve the animal and include it in the person's daily or seasonal bag limit. That's not an or included.
No, yeah,
that's an and. So that implies to me almost that you have to retrieve
it. You have to get it.
And then include it. So a non-retrieval is not counted towards your bag limit is the way that I could very easily interpret this, because it's make a reasonable effort to retrieve the animal or bird and include it.
Include it. As in the as bird the that re- you just the retrieved.
Yeah.
That you reasonably retrieved.
Or is it
or reasonably attempted
or is it
to.
And, or is it and included? I mean, I default on including. I think everybody should default on, I shot, I killed, I know I killed that animal. I know it went down. I am going to notch that off. That is a tag. So if I have 5 deer tags and I didn't recover my deer, that's a tag that's gone. I think that that's the ethical thing to do. Now, we could split the law down any way you want, but I think the ethical, the intention of the law is to make it that only so many animals are killed. Mm-hmm. So if you killed the animal, you should count it. But to me, after reading all of this and looking at it, and the biggest thing is, like, you should have a relationship with your local game warden. Mm-hmm. And these are questions that you should, like, ask your local game warden. And, like, I know that a lot of people are like, oh, Mr. Green Jeans is on the property. You know, Mr. Green Jeans. I've never had a bad encounter with a game warden. Have either of you ever had a bad encounter with a game warden? Oh, here comes Cantrell. Oh, man, Tijuana. I can see him thinking
what
about
can
Tijuana.
What can I withhold in my story?
I've encountered a lot of game wardens, and I don't think I've ever really had a negative. No, every game warden I've come across, if you're, and you hear this a lot on you know, other platforms, like, if you're honest with them, then they're usually, like, great. That's not, like, I've had game wardens approach me and, like, I had a license, I didn't have it on me, and now everything's digital, it's a different deal, but, you know, I was like, I don't have it on me, and they're like, give me your driver's license, and they write all the information down, and they're like, if you hear from me, it's not good,
that means you messed up.
Yeah, right.
But if you don't, like, cool, you're good. That's about, but, like, I also try and abide by all the state and local and federal laws and things they put in place. I know people that have, you know, I've seen people get tickets that, you know, tried to sneak by the system, but I've, you know, we had them come out to the Dove Field opening weekend, and they were all very cordial and, you know, very pleasant. And with me, especially as kind of the steward of the field at that point. And I've never run into, like, some hot-headed, you know, looking for a score kind of game warden. They're just there to enforce the laws that are on the books and I feel bad for those guys because I know there's I've known some that I have had a bad interaction with a game warden.
Oh no!
Here we go.
This was starting off so good.
Hold on. I love my game wardens and I've never had any problems. Okay.
Maybe it wasn't.
There was one game warden in a different state where I was guiding, fly fishing guiding, and he was the rare breed that just he checked me and my client's licenses 3 times in one day.
Oh wow.
Maybe he was suffering from a little Alzheimer's.
He's a young guy.
Early onset.
And he did this to me and other guides multiple times. We were getting complaints at the fly shop I worked at where his interpretation, there was a particular stream that was single hook barbless restrictions on fly fishing. Mm-hmm. He interpreted that as single fly, single.
No dry dropper.
That was his interpretation. Mm. And he was threatening fishermen, guides that he was going to write them tickets, take him to jail. I ended up on the phone for like 2 hours with the game and fish department.
Getting it straightened out
to where I got, you know, to a person where I could say, this is what it is. This is the ruling on this particular situation. And it was, you could technically fish 25 flies if you wanted to, because that was a trial.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, well, single hook barbless fly means that you can have as many single hook barbless flies on a line as you would like. Oh. You may not have a treble hook.
Yeah.
You may not have a fly with a barb.
Oh, okay.
But you may have a dry dropper. You may have a nymph rig you can fish. And that's pretty... But this is a good, like...
25 was the limit, because that's a trot line.
But this is a good...
That was the official ruling.
Pretty funny to throw a 24. Which,
I mean, but this is the thing, is it's like, that's where, like, this gray interpretation and the rubber meets the road, and, like, that's where having a relationship with your game warden, if you have a misunderstanding, clearing it up and saying, this is my interpretation of the law. If we have a discrepancy, let's get to the bottom of it. Let's figure all of this out. You know, I mean, I think the bottom line is most, and game wardens are people too.
Yeah.
So they're going to be subject to all of the things that anybody is, biased and those sort of stuff. But to me, the game wardens in Texas, their title is conservation officers.
Yeah.
So their primary function and goal is not to come out and bust people who are trying to adhere to the law, but their goal is to try to use the laws that have been in place to manage the resources in a way that promotes conservation of our resources. And that's their primary function. And, you know, it's not to take you down when you're, or adhere. And my only run-in with some game wardens was in West Texas. I had some game wardens that showed up one time, like, I mean, it was a new game warden. We were out near Marathon, and this game warden showed up at, like, prime time, like quail. Like, this is the quail
power hour.
Moving. This is the power hour. And I've got clients and they've paid a lot of money to be out there. And I'm like, and we're on a covey of, oh my God, this is a good story. So like, we're on a covey of birds. And like, and my clients are like, man, hey, we're on this covey of birds. I'm like, yeah. Like, well, the game wardens just did the thing where they poked their head in the gate and they parked way down there where they know I can see them. So we're going to go down and visit with them. Man, we got to hunt these birds. No, man, we can't hunt these birds. So like, these guys pay a bunch of money. They're here and I feel bad. So we turn off the birds and we come down and we're rolling down to where the game wardens are. And they're hanging out and they're standing in front of their truck. And we pull up. And as we get about 20 yards away, the biggest freaking covey flushes right in between the two of us. The fucking birds everywhere. Terrible. And so, you know, I went over and talked to him. I was like, hey, welcome to the neighborhood. Glad to have you guys out here. I'm like, here, my guests arrive typically on these days. I've got 3 more groups coming in. They're going to be here, and here. If you want to check licenses and do those things, I would invite you to come to the camp, come up there ahead of time, check all the licenses, do all the stuff. But if we could avoid prime time, like, you know, these folks have paid a lot of money to be out here. If we could not disrupt hunting and you come out and get this knocked out ahead of time, I'll do anything I can do to acquiesce for you getting your job done. And they were like, cool. Yeah, no problem. We'll do that. And then I never saw them again. So, I mean, like, what they did is they came out and assessed that, like, here is a law-abiding citizen who's trying to do the right thing. They met me with, like, open arms and said, here, check my cooler, do whatever. And that was the end of the story.
And I think that's the way it rolls.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately. I got another thing on this. We've this has been a long one on these ducks in a dumpster. Dumpster ducks.
Dumpster ducks.
So, and this one is good. And I'm glad that I have both of you guys here. Because this is cool. Because we're talking about how you can transfer items, how you can transfer a game. You know, we've covered a little bit of like the idea of trying to not waste game. And a lot of these laws all came out of early on when we had market hunters. And it came from the idea that market hunters literally almost killed all the game.
Pump guns.
Yeah, man, they just killed everything. Like just shooting ducks on the water in mass quantities. Like these guys were, no doubt, I will tell you, market hunters were some of the most efficient, lethal hunters that North America has ever seen. These guys were using guns and going out and shooting massive quantities of game to the point of almost extincting ducks, whitetail, and turkey. And it was a sporting hunter. The hunter who did the thing for all the things we've been talking about earlier, that connection to the land, that stepped in, acquiesced, and said, we're willing to pay a tax on our on the ammunition and the firearms that we buy. We're willing to contribute to conservation. We're willing to accept bag limits. We're willing to accept a tag system. We're willing to, we, the hunters, the sporting hunters, accepted all these laws ourselves in order to conserve the population and protect the wild spaces. That was before Greenpeace. That was before the Sierra Club. That was before any of those things existed. And what is so cool about that is that initial sporting person, the spirit, is still what's driving conservation today. And that's why we have all these limits. But talking about the sale of animals, here is the law on the sale of inedible wildlife parts. The following inedible wildlife parts may be purchased or sold if lawfully taken or possessed. Hide, hair, antlers, bones, horns, skulls, hooves, or sinew of the following game animals: mule deer, white-tailed deer, pronghorn, desert bighorn, sheep, gray or cat squirrels, fox squirrels, or red squirrels, javelina, aka the collared peccary, feathered bones or feet of game birds, turkey, pheasant, quail, and chachalaca. Other migratory birds may be used or purchased or sold for making flies, pillows, mattresses, or other similar commercial uses. Feathers from migratory birds may not be purchased or sold for hats or ornamental purposes, nor may a person possess or sell mounted migratory game bird species or their parts taken by hunting.
Whoa.
First of all, what's a chakalaka?
Right? Right?
Chakalaka is another...
It's like a chupacabra.
Fowl. Yeah, it's like it's the chupacabra of the bird world.
It's an upland bird that lives on the border.
Okay. I think it's the greatest name for a bird ever.
Oh, honestly. Yeah.
Chakalaka hunting?
It's one of the last upland bird species for most people to hunt. But mm-hmm. the key element here is like
so
migratory birds.
Possession, not just sale, mm-hmm. but possession. So you're not allowed to possess feathers of migratory birds.
No, you can. Feathers from migratory birds may not be purchased,
purchased.
Or sold. Hats or ornamental purposes, okay. Nor may a person sell a mounted migratory bird. So my birds, my ducks, which I love, like I have the king of the ducks on the wall over here, a spoonbill, of course, duh. Like that, if I were to pass away and my children... Yeah, and I know you're listening to this. They're not listening to this, but maybe one day they will. You can't sell that duck. You got to keep that duck or give it away. But you cannot sell my ducks, my hard-earned spoonbill.
Now, mount. And that goes for, and also mounts like.
Oh, yeah, dove.
Well, no, but I'm saying like
deer,
deer.
No. Let me read
that
this
was, yeah, because there, but there was
migratory birds.
But there was, it was also reading the same thing with,
I picked that up too.
No.
What was that one?
No. You may hair, hide, antlers, bones, horns, skull, hooves, or sinew from the following game animals: mule deer, white tailed deer, pronghorn, desert bighorn, sheep, gray or cat squirrels, fox squirrels, red squirrels, and javelina, a.k.a. collared peccary. Those you may sell.
Okay.
Those can be purchased. So your deer mounts, your white tail mounts, you can sell your white tail mounts.
You see those at antique stores. You're good there,
but you may not sell your duck mounts. That's going to be an illegal transaction.
That's crazy.
Feathers, bones, or feet of game birds, turkey, pheasant, quail, and chachalaca. Other than, I'm sorry, I left a key word out here, other than migratory birds, may be used, purchased, or sold for making flies, pillows, mattresses, and other similar commercial uses. So
you cannot use duck feathers for, or you cannot sell duck feathers. You cannot
sell them. So like in the case where Chris made the hat pin for Holly, you can make that, but you cannot sell that to her.
You can possess it. That's right. You just cannot sell that.
On our Shopify, when we start selling our feathered hat pins, hint, hint to both of you guys that make hat pins here, when we start selling those from our pheasant and our quail and things like that here, that's legal.
Yeah,
and
that's totally legal. That. Right. Yeah.
But
I did not know that you couldn't sell, migratory duck mounts, feathers. I'm assuming that there's probably special licensing because you can get wood duck. You want wood duck feathers for certain flies.
Yeah, let's rewind this back. Right. I mean, it's like you may not be purchased or sold for hats or other ornamental purposes.
Okay.
Or mounts. So they can be integrated into flies.
Yeah.
But they cannot be sold as jewelry or hats. And like, so when you start digging into these codes, you start really understanding what the impact of market hunting was.
Well, the ornamental feather hats was like, that decimated like Papua New Guinea and Africa, like all of these phenomenal birds.
And you guys did read the Feather
Thief.
Feather Thief.
It was such a good book. Like just going,
like now, to like
learning about like why and how and what's going, like, oh,
and that's
why they're.
But flies are included.
Extinct.
You can do flies.
You
it was
can
hats.
Do flies, right.
But like, but to get a lot of, I've got Spencer Syme, who's a phenomenal, like old school salmon tire in New Mexico. That's how he gets his feathers, for tying these old school flies.
Off old hats.
Old hats.
Oh. Yeah,
and like, or like estate sales where they have mounted birds that are like from the past and stuff. Mm-hmm. And
well,
like,
wait, no, you can't buy mounted birds.
But I think because it has to, like the provenance has to be prior to this passage, because he's bought polar bear fur and things like that, but it has to be like,
chain of providence.
Yeah.
No.
There's.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not getting in on this.
Certain age on, it's age. It's a statutory.
So you have to season them. So you have to bury them in your lawn.
It has to be before a certain.
For at least 100 years. And you have to come back and sell them.
Chain of custody.
Chain of custody.
But like,
if you can say like this hat is from like 1924 before a lot of these laws were passed.
Oh, yeah. Then you can sell that. You can sell the hat.
Or the mounted birds. Like,
yes.
This certain date, like you can still. And that's how like a lot of these guys get. But like that's what decimated the birds. Hats.
Yeah.
Hats.
That was in the book. Yeah. It was hats.
Getting fancy.
It wasn't flies. It was
no,
hats.
It's getting fancy.
Hats. Yeah.
And that's what linked it to the flies.
Well, and so like the interesting thing is
hat industry killed an extinct birds.
Yeah. So let's talk about, let's just scratch a little further on that. Right. So like hats. So just here is a thing that was being worn, strictly vanity, beautification, no connection with nature. And I don't know if I'm going to like maybe question that these laws should be revisited a little bit, like mounts. Things like that, like the general purpose, could promote conservation. I feel like fashion and a taxidermy mount are different things. Like a taxidermy mount is something that's going to be sold to somebody who appreciates the species and probably has hopefully bought into the idea of continuing the species. Whereas like somebody on the runway wearing a hat, they don't even care.
No.
And the problem with this is that like these groups like APETA, those sort of things, they've just lumped everybody in to one thing. Hunters, fashionistas, the whole deal. And I just, you know, I would encourage everybody out there to differentiate ourselves. Like, I have mounted birds, not as a fashion state, but as a reminder of the beauty that that nature is. And I, coming to this late in life, I had a hard time. I looked at taxidermy and was like, that's terrible. there's a dead thing on your wall. That's gross. But my perspective has changed so much that when I look at a mount, it's something that allows me to look close at a species that I highly respect and I want to make sure exists on this planet for in perpetuity, beyond the human race, hopefully, even. I don't know. I mean, like, I want to make sure these species are around.
Well, that one will.
That one, that Spoonie, again, the king of the ducks. The king of the ducks.
What is it like the best way to preserve a species is to assign it value. Mm-hmm. And so, like, by assigning it, to assign it value, like either hunting or whatever, that gives that animal value.
Yeah.
And then that will, like, hunters, as we all know, as hunters and fishermen know, like, contribute more to conservation than any group combined. Absolutely.
I look at that, like, beyond assigning value, like before assigning value is giving it a name. And that goes back to sort of what you were talking about with, like, hey, these guys could see, like, there's seven gadwalls coming in. Like, I think the baseline for respecting and conserving is when you start naming things. When you're like, that is a weesach, that is a mesquite, that is a cedar, that's an oak, not just a wall of green. When you're like, that's a teal, that's a widgeon, that's a mallard, is you give things names. And that goes down for, like, everybody. Like, when you're like, oh, those are just whatever people. When you're like, that's Bob or Frank or Bill or Ann or, you know, whatever their name is. Like, when you give something a name, it assigns a value in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it comes back to us as the guides, as the mentors in the space, as the people who people looked at to take them out to do things, to provide people with at the base level when we're rolling down the river, that's an osprey. That's, you know, look at these cypress trees. They're amazing. I love them. Because people you get on the river, you know, they might not even know
this cypress tree. Everything is gray.
What is
everything
that?
Is gray to them.
That's
right,
a bald
right.
Cypress. What?
And that's what you were doing as a guide out on a duck hunting trip, is you were driving those questions and you were being met with duck hunting guides who said, people don't ask us these things.
They just want to shoot ducks.
So our responsibility, I think, is to understand that at the base level, most people don't ask those questions. And it may not be because they don't want to know them. It may be because they're afraid to ask them, because they're afraid to appear ignorant. So our job... And everybody's job.
I get a lot of that, especially on the river. People are like, this might sound like a dumb question.
Stop
like,
saying that.
I'm like,
stop
it's not,
saying that. It's
I'm like,
not at all.
I tell them. Because like, after a while, you're like, it might be.
This one might be.
Might be, but
the other
I'm going to answer it anyway.
I will answer it regardless of what you say. But most of the time, it's a very, like, what is that bird? Like, what is that tree? Like, there's a lot of those, like, naturalist questions that, you know, and when I first started coming down to Texas, it took me. I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I just started learning. I can tell you every type of tree, you know, and encounter in Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, where I spent, you know, 20 years. But then I came to Texas and I had to learn. And I was fascinated by it. I'm like, oh, that's a caracara. One of my favorite birds, even though they're weird, but like, I love caracaras. Seeing one of those was like, I thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
I remember seeing mine for the first
time.
It's
a Mexican eagle. I'm like, that's awesome.
It's a pretty cool bird.
And, you know,
I remember my first time too, guys.
Right?
Your first caracara?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Or like one of the coolest ones was the, what are those giant herons on the coast?
The whooping great crane? Blue herons?
Whooping cranes.
The whooping cranes.
Oh, the whoopers. Herons, cranes. Oh, seeing one of those was like.
That's magic
there. They're super rare.
That's as big as me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know who does it really well is a buddy of mine guides Grand Canyon. The company that he works with, they've been doing it for so long.
River guides are phenomenal.
Oh man, yeah. I did it for a spell in my life. Like, I loved it. But you do it so often that you learn so much. And you get this appreciation of teaching the mm-hmm. whole time. And again, you get that, you, as guides, we know people are wondering, like, you get that look, like they want to ask something, but they're not going to. So what you should do is, again, just like divulge the information before they even ask.
Absolutely.
And these guides on, it's Colorado River Trail Guide Service, but my buddy Dewey, he knows everything. And he is not a geologist. He is not an astronomy
like
major.
Like Dewey Decimal.
Yes, like Dewey Decimal, yes. Okay. But he, when you're going down a river trip with this crew, like they are just talking the whole time. Yeah. Because that whole journey down the river, it is just that. It's a journey through time and space that you don't even, you just look at it like rocks. Like, no. You are going a mile deep into the earth and history and what created these layers, and they take it upon themselves to teach you all these things the whole way down. And I didn't know that when I first started working with them, and just to get that was just like, wow, it was pretty amazing. Just like all the history and all the geology, and again, goes into astronomy and like looking at the stars, because he's just surrounded by that constantly. So we're just going to teach you about this without you even asking. Like, I had no idea.
I'm going to spoon feed you it.
Well, then that makes people comfortable to start asking questions too. And then it's just like it dominoes into like wonderful conversations and experiences for people to have. Yeah. And like,
that's what we should all as guides strive to do and strive to be, is make sure that people know that it's okay to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have questions, I'm just going to spout off some random.
I'm going to fill space with facts, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I'm going to fill the awkwardness in the boat. Just kidding. Honestly, I'm going to take a minute. You said your buddy Dewey Decimal in the Grand Canyon. I'm going to take a moment to brag on you guys and like the reason why I work with you guys, the reason why we're friends, the reason why we're all here is that we all do that. It is ingrained in our DNA. And if you haven't picked up on it in this conversation with these guys, it's who we are. It is not grip and grins. The reality is what we're doing at Spoke Hollow and what everything here is about is connecting you at a deep level to nature and changing the way you perceive the world. And you guys do that so well. And that's not where this podcast started, but that's where it's going to end. And I just want to thank you guys for doing it and thank everybody for listening and sign off on that one.
Well, thank
Chakalaka.
You, Josh. Chakalaka.
Thanks for tuning in to the Bunkhouse Podcast, proudly brought to you by the fine folks over at Spoke Hollow Outdoors. Looking for an adventure in hunting, fishing, camping, foraging, or general outdoorsing spaces? Then we are your kind of people. We offer outdoor skills classes and hunting and fishing trips for all skill levels. Many of these fantastic experiences happen right here at Spoke Hollow Ranch, located just outside of Austin, Texas. Feel like traveling a little farther? Check out the various Spoke Hollow outposts and hosted haunts around the good old US of A. Interested in learning more? Hop over to SpokeHollow.com. That's SpokeHollow.com. Book a trip. Join a class, tell them I sent you, and who knows, maybe I'll see you at the bunkhouse.